Reporting for Euromoney, I'm Jeff Kessler, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If this were the case, we'd be finding far more cases than what are currently being found if it were a contaminated water supply.
That's environmental health expert Bettina Gunter explaining why tap water has been ruled out as the cause for a typhoid fever outbreak in South Africa. Details coming up. Also, a UN report indicates at least 440 civilians died last year due to brutal fighting between rival factions in South Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Zanzibar's President Hussein Mwinyi said yesterday his country is trying to help about 900 Ukrainians who were trapped there on vacation when Russia last week invaded their country. Authorities say they are communicating with Ukraine's embassy in neighboring Kenya to try to evacuate the tourists to Ukraine's neighbor, Poland. Poland's foreign minister said today they have accepted 400,000 Ukrainians who have fled for safety since Russia's invasion. Zanzibar's beaches and historic stone town attract around 500,000 tourists each year and account for 30% of the semi-autonomous island's output. In South Africa, reformist President Cyril Ramaphosa's reluctance to criticize his Russian counterpart's invasion of Ukraine has citizens asking if their leader is friends with Vladimir Putin. The speculation has been sparked by Ramaphosa's unhappiness with his Department of International Relations when it called on Moscow to withdraw its troops from Ukraine. Like Russia, South Africa is a member of the
Unlike many of his colleagues in the ruling African National Congress,
Darren
the
Taylor
ANC,
has more.
Ramaphosa has never publicly demonstrated romantic affection and admiration for Russia's Communist Party. He is, however, a former anti-apartheid trade unionist with communist tendencies turned super-rich capitalist. Ramaphosa's business interests are legion and include his ownership of the McDonald's fast food franchise in South Africa. That, and that he once paid more than R1 million for a bull for his ranch, have earned him the nickname McBuffalo. University of Johannesburg politics professor Dirk Kotzer has followed South Africa's relationship with Russia for decades. He says Ramaphosa's always had cordial relations with Putin, but isn't particularly close to the Kremlin.
President Ramaphosa still wants to be part of the G20. He wants to be involved in and be invited by the G7 and therefore keeps his options open in all directions and not necessarily leaning very heavily towards Russia. I must say that relationship during President Zuma's time was actually more closer to the Russian government than what it is under President Ramaphosa.
Knowing Ramaphosa, says Kotzer, the president's very disappointed with Putin's actions in Ukraine, even though he's not voicing that publicly. He says it's much easier for countries with strong economies to rage against the Kremlin than it is for poorer nations such as South Africa. Kotzer adds it's actually pointless for Pretoria to place sanctions of its own on Moscow.
Some of the sanctions that, for example, the U.S. has implemented already indirectly affect South Africa, especially in the financial sector. South African banks, for example, won't be able to trade or to become involved in transactions with Russian banks. And that applied, for example, to the sanctions against Iran, as well as the blockade or sanctions against Cuba for many years already. So it's an established principle that the West is using in order to make...
He says although many in Africa maintain what he calls nostalgia for the old Soviet Union, dating back to when it supplied weapons, ideology, and money to wars against colonialism, Russia's influence in Africa at this stage is exaggerated.
It's only the last, I would say, 4 years after the Russian-African summit in Sochi at the Black Sea that Russia started to reach out to the rest of Africa, not only North Africa, because they had traditional relations with countries like Algeria, Egypt, and other Northern African countries, where they are involved in energy provision as well as the selling of military hardware.
Kotzer points out that since the historic summit, most of Moscow's promised investments in sub-Saharan Africa haven't materialized. What has, however, happened is the increasing involvement of Russian mercenaries in several of the region's wars against terror groups such as Islamic State. Kotzer also says it's naive to assume that the conflict in Ukraine is going to force Ramaphosa to make a choice between partnering economically with the West or with Russia.
He's going to have close relationships with both, and that is the approach of the South African government. When we look at the economic relationship at the moment with the Russian Federation, it's not a very extensive one. It is actually in terms of investments in favor of South Africa. There's more South African companies in Russia than Russian companies in South Africa.
South African business interests in Russia include those of international mining giant De Beers, South African farmers, internationally acknowledged as excellent agriculturalists, also have a small but strong presence in Russia, invited there by Moscow about 15 years ago to manage massive grain farms. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa's National Institute of Communicable Diseases, the NICD, has issued a public alert after at least three provinces reported confirmed typhoid fever cases. The agency said there is no cause for alarm. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Typhoid fever is sometimes known as the disease of the poor, as it likely occurs in places with poor sanitation. Symptoms of the life-threatening disease include fatigue, headache, nausea, abdominal pain, constipation, and diarrhea. The NICD says the current cases have been identified in the provinces of Western Cape, Northwest, and Gauteng. First reported in 2020, the total jumped from 83 in 2020 to 110 in 2021. There are three small localized outbreaks located in different places in the Western Cape province, while Northwest and Gauteng have one cluster each. The Institute has dismissed media reports suggesting that contaminated municipal water is the cause. Environmental health expert Bettina Gent explains to VOA why tap water has been ruled out.
If this were the case, we'd be finding far more cases than what are currently being found if it were a contaminated water supply.
However, she says it is crucial for citizens to take preventive measures.
The typhoid bacteria can be transmitted person to person as well as through food, and it's typically through the fecal-oral route. So the best thing to do is to make sure that people are practicing good hygiene and have safe sanitation. So I would be worried or concerned to make sure that people wash their hands, especially before preparing food, as well as after going to the toilet, and take the necessary precautions.
South Africa's major typhoid fever outbreak was in 2005, when 2,900 cases were recorded. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Libyan Foreign Minister, Najla Al-Mangoush, has summoned the Egyptian chargé d'affaires, Tamer Mostafa, over Egyptian media inciting Egypt to invade Libya. An Egyptian journalist close to the Egyptian presidency said Ukraine for Russia is similar to Libya for Egypt. He implicitly indicated the world is distracted with the Russian-Ukrainian war and will not pay attention to any step that the Egyptian army takes in Libya. The prime minister of the Government of National Unity, Abdul Hamid Al-Dabiba, assigned a government committee to facilitate the safe return of the Libyan community residing in Ukraine. VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi discussed these developments with Volkan Poştai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
Ukraine or Russia is certainly not the same like Libya for Egypt. Yes, I know that there are the Awlad Ali and other Libyan tribes settling also in Egypt, but you can't compare the two scenarios. Maybe the world would not pay attention if Egypt would invade Libya right now, but the Algerians and the Turks would certainly do. And Egypt has no interest to escalate the situation in Libya whatsoever. And any direct military intervention would certainly lead to such an escalation. Egypt's role in Libya is the role of a concerned neighbor who is worried about the negative impact of the instability there on its own. Consequently, the main interest regarding Libya is stability. A stability is also a precondition for economic cooperation. I would say Egypt can live relatively well with the Dabeba government, although they would certainly prefer Bashagha to take over, as they expect Bashagha to have a more balanced foreign policy, not so much one-sided leaning towards Turkey as Dabeba, and that he would probably also have more balanced domestic policy between the three regions. Cairo is also probably scared that the continuation of the Dabeba government could lead, or probably would lead, to an increased polarization inside of Libya and eventually to a deterioration of the security situation.
The Prime Minister of the Government of National Unity, Abdelhamid Beiba, assigned a government committee to facilitate the safe return of the Libyan community residing in Ukraine to the homeland. Would that be doable with two competing prime ministers in Libya?
Well, Dabeba's measures about creating this committee fit perfectly into what he's currently doing. I would call it some propaganda to stay in power. The situation in Ukraine is not so much a challenge for the Libyan government. They just need to charter some aircraft to the neighboring countries to bring the Libyan citizens back home who left already Ukraine. The Libyan embassy in Kiev has supported and in part even organized the movement of Libyans from Ukraine to the western neighboring countries. Right now, it is not possible to organize any major evacuation from Kiev anymore, as the military situation in and around the capital is getting more difficult by the hour. The Libyan embassy has moved to Lviv, that's a city close to the Polish border, like most of the other embassies, while the ambassador himself, Adel Issa, he said that he will remain in the city until all the other Libyans have left, a quite brave man. Many Libyans are already in Poland, Slovakia and Romania or on the borders of these countries, and the Libyan embassies in these countries are taking care of them, organizing reception teams at the border crossing sites. So it's just about the logistic challenge to bring them back home to Libya.
Next month, the mandate of the UN mission in Libya will expire. How would the extreme tension between Moscow and Washington over the Russian invasion of Ukraine impact any potential agreement in the United Nations Security Council about the mandate and who heads the mission?
After the Russian aggression against Ukraine, the geostrategic environment has entirely changed. Confrontation and probably thereafter containment of the unpredictable Russian aggressor and of the unpredictable Russian president has replaced the, I would say, limited cooperation before. Any agreements within the Security Council about any significant affairs, not only about UNSMIL, are very improbable right now. I would say a deadlock within the UN Security Council can be expected. No side has a reason to do the other a favor. The United States just declared 12 Russian diplomats persona non grata and expelled them. As it looks now, another technical extension of UNSMIL's mandate for 3 months could take place. This would mean that Stephanie Williams would remain as a UN Secretary General Special Advisor, while UNSMIL Mission Coordinator Raisedon Senenga would continue as an acting head of the mission. Altogether, this is not a positive development in a critical time for Libya, but Libya is currently certainly not very high up on the agenda of the global powers.
That was Wolfgang Poştai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. A UN report indicates that in just a few months last year, at least 440 civilians died in brutal fighting between rival factions in South Sudan. The French news agency AFP said the report was issued today by the UN mission in South Sudan and the UN Human Rights Office. It blames members of the armed forces loyal to President Salva Kiir, as well as militias loyal to Vice President Riek Machar, for the grave human rights violations and abuses committed against civilians during fighting in Tambora County in South Sudan's Equatorial State. Some 80,000 people, according to the report, were forced to flee their homes to escape the fighting. 2 years ago, Kiir and Machar formed a unity government, cementing a peace deal signed in 2019 that brought an end to the conflict in South Sudan. But since then, the country has lurched from crisis to crisis, battling flooding, hunger, violence, as well as political bickering, as the promise held by the peace agreement has failed to materialize. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, the militant Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, which claims to be linked to the Islamic State extremists, launched a deadly attack on Sunday. The armed forces of the DRC, known as the FARDC, and Ugandan troops have been fighting the ADF in the region. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in the city of Goma spoke with VOA's Kate Barn-Dawson about the latest fighting.
On Sunday, in the Watalinga area, northeast of Beni, a neighboring city of Uganda was attacked by ADF militia, who killed 21 people in Watalinga and four other people in their way back to the bush. And they also destroyed many houses and burned the Anglican church.
Was this attack aimed specifically at the community because there were Christians there, or was this a retaliation attack for something, or were they stealing things? Do they know why they attacked?
Let's say all DRC is a Christian country, so when ADF attack, they think that they will kill Christian. Even if they attack in a city like Beni, for them they killed Christian, even if some Muslims were dead also. And as this day, that region is on ongoing operation of FRDC and Ugandan army, so ADF are very angry and they can attack somewhere where they found it's a bit less protected by the army. That's why they attacked Watalinga.
I see. So they basically saw a gap in the defenses and attacked that town.
Yes.
Now, there was new fighting overnight. What happened there?
Yeah, because some farmers saw the way which ADF took when they returned back in the bush, and they gave information to the FRDC, and then FRDC followed the way and found ADF in their way. They fought, and many ADF were killed, and 17 of them were captured, and with lot of guns.
Do they expect to have more fighting in that region?
Yes. Today, Wicha, which is a village 25 kilometers north of Beni, was attacked. And up now, the civil society was registered 7 bodies. You know, the problem is ADF doesn't have a uniform or a location. They can surprise FRDC or locals anywhere and anytime. But at this moment, let's say the ongoing operation is going very, very well, and FRDC is succeeded to take back some ADF areas from the enemy.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in the eastern DRC city of Goma. He was speaking with my colleague, Kate Barn-Dawson. The Nigeria Center for Disease Control says nearly 90 people have died from Lassa fever despite government efforts to reduce infections. The illness is caused by a virus spread by the urine of droppings of rats in foods and other household items. Reporter Munachi Chokes from Abuja has more.
The Nigeria Center for Disease Control, or NCDC, says that 21 deaths and 91 new infections were recorded in the country from February 14th to the 21st. The agency says it has activated its emergency operations to deal with the surge of Lassa fever infections in the country. There is usually an increase in cases between November and May during the dry season. But health experts say cases are now recorded all year round. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, also known as Doctors Without Borders, in collaboration with the Ministry of Health, are supporting Lassa fever treatment in Nigeria. Benjamin Uzoma is the health promotion supervisor of MSF in Ebonyi State, in the country's southeast. He says the hemorrhagic illness requires everyone's attention.
Lassa fever has been a very neglected disease. Over here for quite a number of years, many people think of Lassa fever as a disease of the poor. And so lots of attention wasn't given to it up until 2018, when there was a massive outbreak.
Uzoma says that MSF is working to manage and prevent the disease. Community educators from the group are working to raise awareness of the disease in affected states.
We'll give health talks in the villages and have community engagement. And this purpose of all this is to foster behavioral change. So we continue giving health talks, health education in several communities, in several villages.
The illness can affect the liver, kidneys, and other organs, and can produce fever, headaches, vomiting, and muscle pains. Some survivors who were treated for Lassa fever by MSF recount their experiences.
So when I was tested positive for Lassa fever, I was shocked to the bone because I don't know where it came from. We thought it was the normal malaria and typhoid.
I contracted this Lassa in February. That was when I had the symptoms, and it came like malaria. I thought it was malaria. I did self-medication, bought anti-malaria drugs from a pharmaceutical shop, and when I took it for 3 days, I was still sick. In fact, my situation was worse.
When they commenced the treatment, we started seeing slight improvement. The healing was not automatic, but I commend the personnel that are here.
Okereke Michael Uche is a physician with Doctors Without Borders in Abekaliki, the capital of Ebonyi State. He's concerned about delays in diagnosing the disease due to a lack of rapid diagnostic test kits.
There is a virology center where samples are run, especially for Lassa fever patients, using a polymerase chain reaction, which is called a PCR. We don't have a rapid diagnostic test for Lassa fever. Rapid diagnostic test could be a substitute for PCR in the management or diagnosis of Lassa fever.
He says PCR takes longer to produce results, an issue that hampers treatment. The World Health Organization says good household and community hygiene can contain the spread of the disease. The agency says effective measures against Lassa fever include keeping grain and other foods in rodent-proof containers and disposing of garbage away from homes. Some households may also want to keep cats to control the rat population. Lassa fever is transmitted to humans by infected rats and also by the secretions of people stricken by the illness. In cases, the illness has similar symptoms to malaria. The WHO says it's endemic in many parts of West Africa, including Benin. Ghana, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The agency says about 1% of those infected die, and about 15% of those stricken by the illness are hospitalized. Rehydration and the treatment of symptoms improves survival rates. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks from Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.